Good afternoon. It's a great honor for me to introduce today's world speaker, Dr. Huda Akil. Dr. Akil received her PhD in 1972 from UCLA, and she did her postdoctoral fellowship at Stanford with John Barshas from 1974 to 1977. She joined the faculty of the University of Michigan as assistant professor in 1981, where she's now the Gardner Quarton Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience and Psychiatry and the co-director of the Molecular and Behavioral Neuroscience Institute. She had made tremendous contributions to the understanding of the neurobiology of emotions, of pain, anxiety, depression, and substance abuse. Dr. Akil has investigated the molecular and neuronal mechanisms underlying stress reactivity and their relation to anxiety and depression, and she has received numerous honors and awards. She is the past president of the Society for Neuroscience. She was the president in 2004, and she was elected as a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2000 and to the American Academy of Arts and Science in 2004. In 1994, she was elected to the membership of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science, where she currently serves on its council. So with this, Dr. Akil.
Thank you. Thank you, Francesca, and thank you all for having me here and for coming this afternoon. NIH is another home to all of us. We have, like we feel about family, you know, we love it primarily, but we occasionally have ambivalent feelings, but it makes the love all the more salient. So I would like to today talk to you about circuit neuromics. And if you don't know what circuit neuromics, that's okay, because I made it up. I made up this phrase. And I hope that by the end of the talk, you will see why I tried to come up with a phrase that's called circuit neuromics. I made a phrase before in the past, and it was neural phenotype, and people used it, so I'm hoping this one will catch on. It's like a little hobby on the side. So I want to start by acknowledging my collaborators. This is Dr. Stan Watson, who is a long-term collaborator, and my husband. And since we collaborate together, our lab members for Watson and Akil are called the Wakils. And I will talk about the work of the several Wakils listed here. And look for their names in the corner of each slide. I try to remember to put the name of the relevant scientist. And we've been very grateful for the support of NIMH, NIDA, and the Office of Naval Research that all contributed to this work. I will also be representing the work from a wonderful group of colleagues across multiple other universities, not only within the University of Michigan, but also University of California at Irvine, at Cornell, at Stanford, and UC Davis. And here are the lead investigators in each one of these: William Bunny, Jack Barkas, Rick Myers, and Alan Schatzberg at Stanford, Ted Jones at UC Davis. And most of us are part of a Conti NIMH grant, which has been extremely important in bringing us together. And we also have support from the Pritzker Foundation. And under that umbrella, we are called the Pritzker Consortium. So you'll hear work from the Pritzker Consortium. So today I wanted to talk about our efforts to understand severe mood disorders. And as you all know, these are terrible disorders that cause a lot of personal suffering for people and their family. It directly affects approximately 20 million Americans and many, many people all over the world. And it costs us $45 billion per year, so you can start the whole war if you save that money. There are, as you know, two major classes. One is major depressive disorder, some people call it unipolar to contrast it, to bipolar disorder, which is manic depressive illness. Are you hearing me? Because are you okay hearing me? So, and as you probably also know, mood affective disease is characterized by severe pain, dysregulated emotional control, a sense of having feeling no future, helplessness and hopelessness. But I think that a lot of people also forget that it's a broader illness in that it has cognitive symptoms and it has many physical symptoms, psychomotor retardation, loss of sleep and appetite. And it's interesting, actually, to think about the fact that we don't even have a consensus in the language about what we mean about moods, because for some people, mood is what they feel in that moment. Right now, I'm in a good mood, or I am in a fearful mood, or this put me in a good mood, or watching a movie. But for psychiatrists, they really mean a much more extended affective state. And in that regard, moods are protracted and differ from emotions in that they are less aimed, triggered by a particular stimulus. They may be less intense, but they're more pervasive, they're longer lasting. And I like this expression that they represent the balanced and consistent extension of emotion over time. But some people even mean more than that. They mean sort of a temperamental tendency to feel a certain way, to be very stable, to be more negative, to be more positive, or to be more labile. But in all cases, for us to think about mood, we need to think about some characteristics. This is something we are conscious of as humans, so it's a conscious state, whether it's short-lived or long-lived. It's the product of both internal and external factors, and I think of it as a kind of a subjective feedback about how we're doing in the world. I think of it as a mechanism to give us input on how things are going with our body and our interactions with the environment. And as such, it's part of an adaptive process. And when moods fall apart, it's not that you just feel bad. It is that you cannot really adapt properly to the world. Because a mood disorder just disconnects this ability to evaluate how you're doing in the world affectively as well as functionally. It's a failure in feedback function, and that's why I like to think of them in sort of in a parallel to cognitive functions, where people talk about executive behavior, executive functions, where you order and prioritize and make salience. I see mood disorders as a loss of the emotional aspects of executive function, where you cannot prioritize feelings and responses to the world around you, to yourself and the world around you in an appropriate way. So it's a very costly disorder that sits at the interface with other human beings. It has a social element, has a psychological element, it has a very broad adaptive implication. So in particular, bipolar disorder turns out to be, if you're trying to get at the biology of these diseases, bipolar disorder turns out to be a very good target. While its prevalence is low, and sometimes actually that is good, it's about 1% worldwide, it's very highly heritable. It runs in family, there is a high concordance between monozygotic twins, and because of that, and if both parents are bipolar, the odds of the offspring being bipolar are extremely high. So that is why it's been a target for trying to understand the genetics of this illness and hoping that understanding the genetics of bipolar illness will actually lead us to a better understanding of genetics of mood disorders in general. So there have been multiple linkage studies, but a lot of them were not replicated. There are currently many genome-wide association studies that I'm going to be touching on in a minute. But I want to tell you that this has proven hard, and I think it's hard because, A, it's not Mendelian, so it involves more than one gene. So it is a complex genetic disorder, so it has multiple genes plus interactions with the environment. I think a layer of complexity gets added for most brain disorders because of the nature of the tissue that we are dealing with, the complexity, the circuitry, and the fact that we don't have real access to it in the clinical situation. And finally, I think that in addition, mood disorders are maybe even among the trickiest because of this subtlety, this ephemeral nature, this moment-to-moment change. It's not like a lesion and a permanent damage. It's more something that comes and goes and forces you to think a little bit more about dynamic aspects of brain function, not just static aspects of brain function. So I think it's a big challenge ahead of us. And we in the Pritzker Consortium and the Conti Center decided from the get-go that we wanted to approach this through at least two general approaches. In order to derive new hypotheses, we wanted to use genetic tool and gene expression profiling to come up with potential either allelic variants or new targets or susceptibility genes, and that we would cycle through, so whatever targets came out from genetics would go back and get asked to see if they affect patterns of gene expression in the brain or going vice versa, so that we would bring as much convergence as possible to this equation. And obviously, as a complex genetic disorder, our vision of it is that it's a gene environment, the product of a gene-environment interaction with vulnerability genes. We all know that stressors or life events are very important in triggering these illnesses. We shouldn't forget about the role of development or about modifiers like gender and hormone. But I think what is missing in this equation is the brain. And the brain is really the place where gene and environment meet, where they interact, and they're not interacting against some kind of static tissue. I think what is important in the brain is that the experience itself of the depressive disorder or the bipolar illness comes back and changes the neural phenotype of this brain. So two people who have exactly the same genetics and even the same general background, if they encounter different life events and one becomes depressed and the other doesn't, will wind up with a very different brain because of this mechanism of remodeling that changes not only gene expression, but changes the very characteristics of the morphology of neurons, whether we're talking about number of branches or number of spines or connectivity or, you know, glia and so on and so forth. So let me, with that sort of a schema in mind, I wanted to just quickly tell you about where we stand in our effort in looking for vulnerability genes. So the Pritzker Consortium has undertaken a study with bipolar I cases using DNA that was gathered by the NIMH genetic initiative, as well as a small set of samples through the Heinz Prechter repository, bipolar repository. And these, we picked only those people who have European or primary European ethnicity, and there were some siblings involved in here, and we take that into account in our analysis. Because that in some ways decreases your power. The controls actually turned out to be quite an adventure to get the right controls, but eventually we wound up with 792 controls, again from the NIMH Genetic Initiative through Pablo Gejman. And these were recruited through internet participation, and we chose only those that were approximately correctly ethnically matched to our cases. But we also eliminated a lot of people who remotely looked like they might have mood disorders that is underreported in this population. We carried on the genotyping using an Illumina platform, the Illumina Human HAP550. This has 541,000 SNPs, and I won't go through the details, but the mechanics of the genotyping were extremely good. The quality controls were fantastic. So at the end of this, with approximately 2,000 total cases in control, we did not get anything that has so-called genome-wide significance, because you're trying to correct for the fact that you are making 550,000 comparisons. The criteria for significance are extremely high. You need something, either very large numbers or 10 to the minus 8, and we don't have anything that meets that. These are our top SNPs, five of them. The closest genes within 100 kbs are here. And actually, we looked at them and we thought, well, cool, interesting, protein kinase C, diacylglycerol, not bad, you know. And then you can come up with some potential biology that is relevant to at least the PKC epsilon and the diacyl glycerol, including interactions with GABA receptor, voltage dependent calcium channels, anxiety behavior, and so on. But I'm not dwelling on this biology because the proof of the pudding is in the replication. And there, and so let me tell you where that stands. So this is the Pritzker study that I've just told you about. I'm going to tell you a little bit about this one in a minute. There were three published, there are now, by now, three published bipolar genome-wide association studies, none of which has very large number. One was is the Wellcome Trust, the WTCC, that has 1,800 cases and about 3,000 controlled. There is Baumerall from here, from McMahon's group, looking at some pooled set of samples that are overlapping with some of the samples that we have done, and then following this up, the specific SNPs independently in a German cohort. And then there is the work of Pamela Sklar and colleagues at the Broad Institute where she used STEP-BD, and there's 1,400 cases and 2,000 controls. And there is more cooking, you know, gain and so on, but I'm just telling you what's out there. And so it's very important to look at what everybody brings to the table and how it comes together. And here is our first attempt at looking at it. When we looked at our top hits in WTCC, there was absolutely no confirmation in anything that we had come up with. So you can see that it was very low p-value. In the SNPs that we came up with, for example, the protein kinase C, had absolutely no significance in the WTCC. So that makes you kind of nervous. That didn't replicate. So when we looked the other direction, we looked at what the WTCC, the Wellcome Trust people's, their top hits, and we looked at our data. It wasn't a whole lot better because their numbers are somewhat higher. They carried some weight, and there was only one case, actually, an unnamed SNP where we, you know, in a region that's a no man's land, where we actually improved the level of significance by pooling ours and theirs. Otherwise, we actually went against them. So that's very disheartening. You know, this is after a few million dollars have been spent on this undertaking. And it makes you think that maybe everything has very small effects. But we have done a recent meta-analysis. It's ongoing and it's not done, and I can't tell you the final story, but I'm feeling a little bit more optimistic, and so I was just going to tell you where it stands. So this is, we established a collaboration between the Pritzker Consortium and GSK with Pier Andrea Muglia. And GSK had studied a 900 bipolar and 900 control subjects, also using the Illumina platform. So we agreed to completely share data between us, and when we did that, we got absolutely nothing between us. It's very sad. But then we took all this data and we put it together with the, as one meta-analysis, we put it together with the Wellcome Trust. And instead of just taking our top hits and comparing them to theirs and vice versa, we just put all the data together, which meant that Laura Scott and Mike Binky, who are doing all the hard work on the statistical genetics, had to do a lot of, to do the imputation because this was done on a different platform. They had done it on Affymetrix. Ours is Illumina. You have to bring that information together, which is what the imputation is about, and then see how much concordance there is. But now analyzing it as if it is one body of work. There was a little bit of overlap, actually, between the GSK and the Wellcome Trust, so we had to get rid of that. And the other thing that Laura and the rest of us decided to do is to increase the control group, and this you may or may not agree with. But the Wellcome Trust people had many other diseases that they had been studying at the same time, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, and so on. And since the incidence rate of bipolar is 1%, we decided maybe it would be worth taking a risk and calling these disease controls and adding them into the equation, but always monitoring whether they are carrying the inform of any differences is because you've got people who are sick with other illnesses, or whether the difference is a real difference. For example,
the HLA region would pop up as highly significantly different. But that is because a lot of these people have illnesses that include changes in the HLA region. So we took that out of the equation. And after each analysis, we always compare it with control, real controls versus the two sets of controls. So it just adds power. And in the end, we wound up with 3,600 different cases of bipolar, 4,600 real controls, and over 10,000 disease control, people who had other illnesses but not bipolar illness. And according to Laura Scott, this is sort of the equivalent power of having 5,000 cases and 5,000 controls. So it allows for a somewhat greater power than any of the studies by themselves. So when we did that, we got a number of SNPs showing up that had never been reported before. In the 1 to the minus 7 to the best was 9 to the minus 10, 9 times 10 to the minus 8, which is definitely genome-wide significance with those kinds of numbers. And one particular region of the genome popped up that has more than one SNP in it. They're validating this. I would love to tell you what it is, but they told me they'd kill me, so I'm not going to say what it is, unfortunately. But we should let it out very, very soon if it confirms. They're trying to confirm it with Pamela Sklar's stuff if we can get the imputation done. So the important thing about what we found is that it suggests that there is some commonality, and this commonality was not the top SNPs in any of the individual studies. If you looked at those genes, those SNPs that came up were buried deeper. For example, one of the SNPs that's very good for in the overarching analysis was at 10 to the minus 5 in the WTCC. So this is exactly what happened in the study of diabetes. Things that were deeper, buried deeper, emerged when you put a lot of samples together. So, and each of the body of work contributed to these things. So it wasn't driven by one paper or by one data, set of data or another. It was not due to the non-bipolar disease controls. And as I said, we're trying to do some additional imputation, and we're part of this big consortium that's trying to bring all the data out there together and analyze it in parallel. So what I take from that is a little bit more optimistic than I had been before. It does say that we may find some common vulnerability genes or regions that increase the risk of bipolar illness. And whether we talk about this region or whatever everybody else has found, you know, some of these genes make sense. But, of course, they all will need deep follow-up and analysis to actually implicate particular genes. But in general, I am told that after you do all of this and with the best kind of optimism, we only explain a small percent of the variance. So there are lots of interpretation about this. It's possible that, you know, these effects can be not only additive, but you have a lot of little genes that have not only additive but also synergistic effects. It's also very likely that there are many other kinds of genetic variations, including rare mutations, copy number variations, things like is coming up for schizophrenia, for example. But it's also very likely, in my mind, that there is true disease heterogeneity, that the genes that make me bipolar in my family may not overlap at all with the genes that make you bipolar in your family. And yet, they have to kind of come together to produce a phenotype that looks consistent and looks to the naked eye of the clinician as if it's one disease. And to me, this is where circuits are important. So I want to therefore switch to talking about circuits, and I want to quote a great neuroscientist who said, "Thought is not merely the sum of the small thoughts of individual neurons. Neurons are not likely to each be a little bit conscious. Instead, thought appears to have qualitatively different properties from the neurons which engender it. It's an emergent property of neuronal integration." I don't know if you recognize who it is. I didn't say he was a famous neuroscientist. I said he was a great neuroscientist. He's my son, and that's from his PhD dissertation, his introduction, and I just liked it. I thought I'd give him some PR. But I agree with him that you know, you really cannot think of mood or thought or anything conscious in terms of only one region at a time. And clearly, through neuroimaging studies, we show you that when people are, for example, thinking a sad thought, it's pretty distributed in the brain. This is from Alan Schatzberg. And the differences between the control the depressed subjects and the control subjects, even, you know, at rest, are reflect multiple areas that are different, you know, both frontal and limbic and cortical, that are altered in depression. So I like to make the analogy that this is really about choreography. The circuitry is about the choreography, and each dancer may be dancing perfectly, but if the integration is wrong, it's still off. And that's, sooner or later, we have to grapple with this. And we are nowhere near doing it, but I think that we need to get back into the brain and see how some of this is playing, whether it's primary or secondary, and see if we can detect some signatures and then refine these signatures in the brain and see if we can understand how these illnesses seem to be playing out at the neural level and kind of work back and forth between the genetics and the neural phenotype. So let's talk a little bit about the idea of neural phenotype. I'm going to go a little quickly with this because a lot of it is published, but this is, we're relying on a brain bank that both Bunny at Irvine and Ted Jones have established, and we're using a discovery approach. We're using earlier Affymetrix gene expression and more recently Illumina gene expression to look at patterns of gene expression in multiple brain regions in subjects who have died either with bipolar or depression. We actually have a schizophrenia group in there and normal control. And this, we do a lot of selection. That's Bunny's estimate is like out of 1,200, you might wind up with 24 by the time you cut off all the issues. And I will mention very quickly one of those about appropriate kind of tissue to get. We went in there with a very open mind about the circuitry, where this is going to be. So we dissect a total of 22 brain regions from these brains, and then we go further and micro-dissect. This is a slide from Stan Watson, where in human brain, where he uses laser capture micro-dissection, and he guides it by, for example, labeling paraventricular nucleus with area with vasopressin, with CRF, with pro-opiomelanocortin, putting it together, and with laser capture, picking up specific groups with, you know, known molecular signatures to them. And they're doing 3D reconstruction to do this correctly, and then laser capture micro-dissection followed by microarrays. And this has been done in hypothalamus, in the locus coeruleus, in the raphe, and it gives much better, much more beautiful data than when you take a chunk of tissue and just grind it up. So I wanted to quickly mention that a very, very big important impact of a consideration to make in studying postmortem tissue is this distinction between what we call type 1 and type 2. Patients' brains that come with pHs at 6.8 or below show a very different gene expression profile than those that are above. And those are usually associated with people who died a slow death. Slow death triggers activity of huge pathways, very biological activity of mitochondrial genes, stress responses, stress, cell death, that hugely overwhelms any impact of the disease on the brain. And so basically, in the end, we have had to completely eliminate the study of these people. I don't feel like you can regress for it or correct for it. And we only study people who have what we call zero agonal factor. They died rather quickly, both patients and controls, and have a pH above 7. If you do that, you start getting some interesting answer. And one of the biggest first answer is that even though everybody died depressed, bipolar and unipolar alike were depressed at the time of death, the signature of the illness on their brain is quite distinctive. So they have really clearly different patterns of gene expression. For example, the major depressive disorder shows many more changes in gene expression in the hippocampus, whereas In the nucleus accumbens, we see many more changes in the bipolar patients. So gene expression is probably reflecting a long-term ongoing disease process. We have reported on a number of genes and single families, families of genes that have been altered by these various diseases, and I'm going to focus on one of them. And I'm going to focus here a little bit on major depression and tell you that what was remarkable is also the gene families that turn out to be altered in these diseases. So in the case of schizophrenia, there was one big, huge hit, and that was major histocompatibility complex family. Huge difference between them and control and every other group, and some very specific and interesting gene that distinguished between them. In bipolar, it was yet a different pattern. For the major depressive disorders, we had a bunch of hits, a lot of them having to do with cell morphology, cell development, cell signaling. Each one of these are different brain region, but each one of the titles below is a different ensemble of genes defined by informatics. So based on that, it did look like there was something to do with neuroplasticity that was altered in major depression. So we pursued that and we looked at growth factors. This is an updated from the PNAS paper, and we've done it in every brain region so far, like 12 brain regions that we've done, but I'm showing you amygdala, anterior cingulate, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and the hippocampus. And I'm showing you vascular endothelial growth factor, neurotrophins like BDNA and their receptor, insulin-like growth factor, and a family that emerged as the single most significantly altered family, which was the fibroblast growth factor family. And as you can see, there is a neurotrophin hypothesis, and track B was changed, was decreased in every brain region that we've looked at here. So we did bring some confirmation to that. But as I mentioned, the biggest change was in this family, and it was a mixed bag. The receptors were generally downregulated, so we take it to mean that the overall tone of the signaling was down. And FGF2 in particular was down in every brain region we've looked at. But by contrast, FGF9, another member of the FGF family, was upregulated in every region we've looked at. So that left us with questions about what is the function here. Before I go to the animal studies, I just want to mention that early on we looked at whether this could be due to the treatment, and we separated patients based on history about whether they had been treated or not treated. So this is the difference in a patient subset of patients who were not on any antidepressant treatment. And here are those that were, and you can see that treatment actually reverses some of the difference between the controls and the MDD, suggesting that actually this is associated with the illness and not the treatment, but of course it remained to be tested. So this was sort of where we left the human and went to the animal validation. We knew that this was a complicated family with 22 members, with several receptors expressed in the brain, but we also learned that it was particularly changed in major depression and that some things were up and some things were down. And so our approach was to then go from the gene expression profiling, bioinformatic, and so on, and ask, is this just a chance or a secondary change, or does this system really play a role in emotional reactivity, in emotionality, in mood? Nobody had really clearly implicated FGF in particular in that system. So I'm going to go through very kind of quickly, highlight some studies that convinced me that, in fact, FGF is a very, that family is very important in mood disorders, or at least with the control of anxiety and negative affect, and maybe even positive affect. So the first question is this something that you're born with and it stays, or is it modified by experience? And is the direction of the change consistent with what we might expect given the human findings? So we went with the fact that we wanted to study social stress in the rat, And we wanted to study, in particular, social defeat, which is a model we have been using for many, many years, because we feel that it activates some of the same pathways that we see in human depression. So in rats, for you to get social defeat, you need to make an animal territorial by housing it with a female. For a couple of weeks, they become territorial. And then if you introduce an intruder, the resident attacks them. Typically, the resident wins, the intruder loses. If you do that repeatedly over several days, you will get a depression-like phenotype in the losing animal. And this has recently been used by a number of people. And as I said very early on, we found that some of the same brain regions that are affected by losing, not by fighting, but by losing, are very parallel to what is seen in especially in affective disorders. So we used this model and we asked, if you lose, does this affect your FGF system? And the answer is yes, that if you're a control animal just handled, looking here at the hippocampus, compared to a repeatedly socially defeated animal, the social defeat animal have a very, in some region, very profound decrease in the expression of FGF2. In several regions of the hippocampus. And that is also true for one of the FGF receptors, FGFR1. So that here, this decrease parallels the decrease in FGF2 that we've seen in depressed humans. So then the question is, does it work if you give it? Can you give it and reverse some of that? And first, there was no way to know, in fact, if FGF would work as a kind of a drug in the brain. It had been given in the periphery and studied very well and known to activate a number of signaling pathways, but we decided to look at the changes in signaling proteins after in vivo injection, and we asked to look at that within a very narrow time window, because this is a growth factor. It's important in development and remodeling, but is it signaling? And so we tested it after 30 minutes of acute administration of either ICV or periphery, an hour after peripheral administration of FGF. And we looked at a number of proteins that had been implicated in the signaling of FGF in the tissue culture. And here is an example of ERK1. It does not change in the cerebellum, the prefrontal cortex, or the hippocampus as a total protein, but phospho-ERK changes specifically in the hippocampus after you inject FGF2. And in fact, if you look at the entire family of signaling molecule after the injection of FGF, you find that you see many, many changes, specifically in the hippocampus, increased in all of this signaling cascade that has to do with neurotrophic activity, with cell survival, with cell growth, with axonal and synaptic growth. But they are triggered within a half hour in terms of phosphorylation, and they actually are distinctly different from what we see in the prefrontal cortex. So they are regional and sometimes going in opposite direction. But what that taught us is that, in fact, FGF can work, and it can work quickly. So we started asking if we can use it in a classic antidepressant test, which is the forced swim test. In real life, animals don't wear a floater. They decide to float when they give up on trying to escape. So the more the float, the more depressed-like they are, and antidepressants are supposed to decrease floating or helplessness. So in that test, we give FGF2, and looked at the floating at multiple doses. I'm just showing you one. It's not necessarily even the best one. And what it did is it increased swim time and it decreased immobility, looking antidepressant-like. We took an inhibitor of FGF2, something that competes with FGF2 at the receptor, a small peptide molecule, and it did just the opposite, which is always interesting if you get a reverse change with an antagonist. It actually increased immobility and decreased swim, suggesting that there is a tonic activity of FGF in the brain. And we also looked at NCAM, and it's a partner of FGF, and it also was antidepressant. We also asked, about FGF9. You remember FGF9 went in the opposite direction in the human brain. We asked, what does it do if you give it? And the answer is it acts as a depressant. So it is antagonistic physiologically to FGF2. It increases immobility significantly and decreases climbing and swimming. So far I've told you that these transcripts get decreased in an animal model of depression. I didn't tell you about the splice variants in stress, but they are altered by stress, and the splicing of the receptor is altered by stress. FGF2 and its molecular partner, NCAM, act as an antidepressant, whereas FGF9, which is increased in depressed brains, act as a pro-depressant. So we wanted to know if could there be any kind of predisposition to any behavior like anxiety or emotionality that we could associate with native differences in FGF? Could it be a predisposing factor? And can you modulate it in creatures with different predispositions and get differential effects? And so we would love to look directly at vulnerability genes, but in the rat, they're not that far along. So we took a slightly different approach. We had been trying to breed a model of temperament in our rats, contrasting what we call externalizing disorders to internalizing disorders. So externalizing disorders are kind of interest to people who study, for example, gambling and drug abuse and so on. They tend to be associated with high novelty seeking, impulsivity, and aggression. And people think of them as having kind of a disinhibitory syndrome with conduct disorders and attention deficit. Whereas internalizing disorders are often associated with a behavioral over-control, and they are, at the extreme, associated with depression, anxiety, OCD, some somatic disorders, and so on. So we wanted to see if we can sort of begin to model that in the animal. And we had multiple objectives that, you know, when we started the study for lots of reasons, but I'm going to just tell you what we wound up with. So what we did is we started with a very simple behavior, which is how much an animal will explore a new environment. And some animals are so-called low responders, and they tend to be very timid. They stick to the corners. They never go look at a novel object in the middle. They're like real scaredy cats, never even make it around the whole perimeter. Whereas here is a high responder animal who really investigates and goes close, goes to the middle. And so in general, in the next segment, high responders are green for go, like traffic. Low responders are red for stop. They tend to stop more. So we bred those animals. We did selective breeding, starting from an outbred line. We're like generation 20 by now. We try to avoid inbreeding as much as possible, although you do after many generations. And we're trying to isolate the extremes of these behaviors. And in fact, I'm going in the wrong direction. These animals diverge very clearly, both males and females, so they become more extreme. And I will tell you that the outbred animals, we always test them, sit right in the middle, so they are diverging in both directions. The other thing is that you greatly improve your ability to predict. So without doing any behavior test, we have almost 100%, 98 to 100% certainty now of the phenotype of the animal just based on their genetic history. And I'm not showing it to you, but this has not to do with maternal behavior. Maternal behavior is very important for the intermediate or the mixed phenotypes or the F1 phenotypes, but at the extreme, maternal behavior does not change the phenotype. So that's really helpful because you can do developmental studies without having to test the animals behaviorally. So we have characterized these animals in lots of ways about on anxiety, depression, aggression, impulsivity, how they make association to environmental cues, whether they take drugs of abuse, and learning and memory. And they differ in each one of these, and I'm going to go through it really quickly. Like elevated plus maze, forced swim test, etc. In all cases, The low responder animals tend to be more depressive, more anxious, and they respond to the drugs, to the human drugs, as you would expect. So antidepressants work for them, anti-anxiety drugs work for them. And the high responder animals are essentially treatment resistant. So if you do, for example, subject the animal to social defeat first, and then ask, and then put him through the swim test and see how quickly they give up, you find that the high responder animals, the high risk-taking animals, are pretty resilient. They don't change their behavior in terms of immobility very much, whereas the low responder animals are very vulnerable to the social defeat. They become even more extremely different and immobile. They change more, so they are much more vulnerable to the environmental stress on them. So in general, then, they really seem to kind of characterize a kind of a one novelty risk-taking phenotype for the high responder, and the low responders are greater anxiety, depressiveness, reactivity to stress in while being treatment responsive. So I'm going to go through this quickly because I want to get back to FGF. So this very early in development, and it's all to do with the hippocampus, surprisingly. So we looked at these animals early in development, and we found that they have significant differences in both gene expression in the hippocampus and the rate of neurogenesis in the hippocampus. And it was interesting that FGF is implicated in neurogenesis as a very early phase. So that kind of led us to wonder if FGF may be an important early switch gene in that phenotype. And we gave, so this is an example of how there are early differences in rates of proliferation, then on day 7, then they kind of catch up on day 14, then they differ again on day 21. But the other thing that was very interesting is what we found, that you could inject FGF once, one day after birth, and you could change the animal's hippocampus and emotional behavior for the rest of his life. So the rate of neurogenesis would change, the density and packing of the hippocampus was changed, and when you gave FGF, you made animals less anxious and more HR-like, more prone to taking drugs. So we wound up with the idea that FGF actually biases you away from internalizing disorders and towards externalizing disorders. So we asked in the adult, if we take these internalizing and externalizing disorder models, animal, and look at FGF, what happens? And in fact, we do find that there is more FGF in the hippocampus of the high responder, high risk-taking animals compared to the more anxious, low risk-taking animals. And what is interesting, this summarizes the group data here, but also there is a very nice correlation between the magnitude of FGF2 expression in the CA2 and the time the animal is willing to spend, say, in the open arms of the elevated plus maze or any number of tests of anxiety. The more FGF you have, the less anxious you are, the more willing you are to take risks in this measure. The other thing is, if you do stuff to animals to make them less anxious, do you affect FGF? So this is an environmental complexity where you give them a toy a day for 3 weeks while they're young adults. And so there is a rat here running around. And what happens is that these animals become less anxious if they are living in a more complex environment. And what you do is, it's been known, of course, that you get increase in neurogenesis in these animals for a long time. But what we found is that this environmental complexity also upregulates the expression of FGF2, and that this happened primarily in the animals that were the low responders, that had somewhat lower levels, and profited more behaviorally, and they increased their FGF2 more when they were exposed to this enriched environment. So then we had shown you before that it was antidepressant-like in its action, and so we asked, is it anxiolytic? And acutely, it's actually somewhat anxiogenic, like a lot of SSRIs. But we gave it chronically over the period of 3 weeks, one peripheral shot of FGF. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. One peripheral shot every 2 days over 2 or 3 weeks, and we looked at it. And we saw the following. We saw that these are the high anxiety, low responder animals, and this is the time spent in the open arms. You can see that compared to their counterparts, they were pretty anxious. When we gave them FGF, they greatly profited in terms of becoming much less anxious, whereas it did not help the high responders at all. If anything, it went in the opposite direction. This is the counterpoint time in the closed arm. It decreased it. And this is in the light-dark box, just another measure, done open field. In general, chronic FGF2 administration changes the behavior of only the more anxious animals, does not touch the animals that are already highly exploratory in their behavior. So this, the kind of differential effect is very, like it's, you know, personalized medicine for the rats. And then the other thing we asked is, what does it do to the hippocampus? Well, the chronic FGF did not change Ki-67, so rates of birth between either the high or low responder animals. But we also looked at cell survival, looking at BRDU, and we saw the following interesting thing. We found that it did increase cell survival, again, only in the low responder animals who changed behaviorally, also upon FGF treatment, showed greater survival of the newly born stem cells. And these stem cells are not exactly distributed the same between the two groups. There is a somewhat more uncommitted stem cells in the more anxious animals and less glial cells. So that already is kind of weird and interesting. But what is interesting is what FGF treatment did. So I showed you before that it's the low responder animals that responded the most. Now we're looking at BRDU and another marker for either neurons or glia. And what we see is that, as you might expect, the high responder animals really did not show a major change in any of the phenotypes. But the low responder animals doubled their rates of survival of neurons and quadrupled the rates of survival of glia and decreased the number of uncommitted cells. So it's like it enhanced either differentiation or survival of both neurons and glia, but particularly glia. So in general then, what I've told you about this animal model is that basally, that FGF2 goes with anxiety, that basically animals that are high FGF2 have lower anxiety, that if you decrease anxiety through environmental manipulations, you induce FGF, that if you give FGF externally, you decrease anxiety, and you do it particularly in the most anxious animals, and that some of the neural correlates, including cell survival, seem to be associated with the chain, with this chronic administration and selectively. And to me, as a little aside, I wanted you to note how often the hippocampus, we look at other areas, keeps coming up in this difference in temperament and as a target of a lot of these regulations. So there are many questions, of course, to address, but of course what's important is to take it back to the human and ask, you know, what does that tell us about whether FGF is important in the propensity for internalizing or externalizing disorders in the human? Is this difference genetically driven, or is it, you know, environmentally driven? Does it respond in the human to the environment the way we saw in the animal? And can it be a biomarker for either disease vulnerability or drug responsiveness the way we have seen? So now I have run out of time, but I want to take 2 minutes and talk to you a little bit about why, and I'm going to spare you slides, I'm just going to say it, why I think circuit neuromics is the next direction. I think I've given you a flavor that you can learn a lot from looking at the brain. And you can discover that things are important in circuitry that you had no idea. I would not have started with the hippocampus, but that's what the data showed me in the development studies, that the hippocampus is what discriminates these animals in, based on gene expression. So we look there. We have found in the human that if we do unbiased correlation of all the gene expression data that we do, correlating gene expression between regions in an unbiased way, that the most dramatic things that happen with illness is a change in the correlation of gene expression between areas. So let me be specific. The amygdala and the prefrontal cortex have a bunch of genes that seem to correlate in their expression with each other in any given brain. It doesn't have to be the same gene or a gene and its receptor. Sometimes you don't know why this glutamate receptor and this splicing enzyme are highly correlated, but they are highly correlated. What you see in a lot of the diseases is that the biggest change is the change in this coupling. For example, bipolar actually increases the coupling between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex. And in other, like in major depression, you can get some loss of coupling between various regions. So what I'm saying to you is that other than neuroimaging, we have a ways to go to figure out what the circuits are that are relevant in an unbiased way. But then we have a huge number of new tools as well, including all the fancy epigenetic tools, microRNA tools, increasing sophistication in our dissection, and increasing ability to couple anatomy and gene expression on top of all these cool techniques of light activation of particular circuits in animal models. So I think that in this idea of a dance of choreography, we need to first figure out, Nuriev said it's about, you know, time and space, you know, and energy. And we really need to figure out all these aspects of the circuit. Its anatomical location, its spatial relationship, but also the time, the dynamics of interaction in time. And I feel like even though we are making progress, we won't make real progress for understanding mood disorders in particular because of their transient, sometimes transient nature, until we take on the whole circuit and use all the omic tools that we can possibly get a hold of to kind of reconstruct the disruption at the circuit level. So I'll hush and thank you for your attention. And I'm happy to take a couple questions.
Yeah, we have time for two questions, but you are welcome to join Dr. Akila at the reception and ask more questions if you have any. Thank you.
It wasn't clear to me what you thought was going on with the HLA.
Well, the HLA is simple. Oh, you mean in the schizophrenia you're talking about?
Yeah.
I actually don't know if it has anything to do with, like, immune function. And the reason I'm saying this is that because of the work of Carla Schatz, who has shown that sometimes some of these genes are also important in synaptic formation and synaptic development. And so it may be a very central brain development effect that we're seeing, and I think that we haven't pursued it in the same way that I've, like, looked after the FGF, but there's a lot to be done there. Yeah. Yeah, Tom.
Huda, can you say what you mean by a circuit in the circuit neuromics?
What did I say? What?
What is a circuit?
So I would define it very empirically, the way I quickly ran through what response to certain stimuli. Ensembles of brain region that coordinately respond to a certain stimulus and or get significantly disrupted, either individually. Sometimes we never see a disruption locally. We only see a disruption in the correlation. So if we can get those kind of cross-correlational functional analyses, I think we should define the circuits, of course, guided by all the neuroimaging and all the animal work, but also to some extent empirically based on what the brains tell us. So that's really what I mean by that. And the neuromics is obvious, you know, the omics in the brain, adapted to the brain. Okay, thank you all for your attention.